And then finally, medications. You know, medications not for weight loss, but actually medications that promote weight gain. Mm-hmm. Jamie, do you want to talk about some medications that promote weight gain?
Sure. As we know, with obesity, several comorbid conditions can be associated with that, and our patients are likely treated for those comorbid conditions. But unfortunately, there are several medications, as you mentioned, that can promote weight gain. When we talk about the anti-diabetic medications, I think we're all aware that insulin can have a weight a gain. The other medication in the anti-diabetics is the TZD classes, such as pioglitazone. Those medications can cause a significant weight gain in patients who are already morbidly obese. It's not uncommon for them to experience a 40 to 50 pound weight gain when using those.
And in addition to weight gain, fluid retention.
Exactly, right. So certainly if other classes of medications can be used to control blood sugars, that will not precipitate the obesity.
Is there one that you use routinely?
Certainly metformin is a great choice to start with, and many patients can see a modest amount of weight loss when metformin therapy is initiated.
And that's an insulin sensitizer, too,
yes.
Just like that. It affects the liver, and thioglitazone affects the muscle. So.
Yes, yes. In some other classes of medications, we were talking about the antidepressants. The tricyclic antidepressants can promote weight gain, some of the SSRIs as well. We tend to use a lot of fluoxetine. In the clinic, it tends to be the most weight-neutral medication, so that's certainly a good option. Several antipsychotic medications can promote weight gain. Other classes of medications as well, antihistamines, steroids, of course. So I think as clinicians, we just want to be aware of potential weight gain with the medications that we are using for our patients and try to stay away from those if possible and use other more weight-neutral medications.
Right. You know, with regards to the SSRIs, there's one that causes weight gain in about 23% of individuals. Do you know which one that is? It's a great medication, but
Paxil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and that helps for both depression and anxiety too. Mm-hmm. But it can promote weight gain. The other class that's gotten some press recently is topiramate, Topamax. That's currently FDA approved for pain and seizures, I believe, in children. But that was just up for FDA review recently, and with combination of phentermine. Mm-hmm. So, and that was shown to be promising for weight loss in individuals with migraine headaches and chronic pain, hence the use as a weight loss formulation with phentermine, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. The other thing is with concomitant use of insulin and thioglitazones, those individuals can gain a significant amount of weight and fluid retention. Mm-hmm. So you really want to make sure, as you said, that you don't prescribe someone a medication that can promote weight gain when they're struggling with weight loss. So how do we define obesity? I know it used to be that if you weighed more than your doctor, they'd say you're overweight and here's a 1,500-calorie diet and come back. You know, and then we went to the Metropolitan Life Tables, which, you know, Mrs. Jones, you're 180% of your ideal body weight. You know, that didn't mean much to Mrs. Jones or the doctor. So now we use the body mass index, which I'm sure everyone is familiar with. But I really like to think of the body mass index as another vital sign. I mean, everyone gets a height, a weight. I think calculating the body mass index is very helpful for our patients because it really takes away the weight issue. The body mass index correlates very nicely with morbidity and mortality. So as our body mass index goes up, so does the rate of all the comorbid medical problems. And clearly, we can say, Mrs. Jones, your BMI is 35. We don't have to say, well, Mrs. Jones, you weigh 285 pounds. You know, we can really use this as a tool to take off the weight issue onto an index that correlates with morbidity and mortality. So I think that is very important. And in our clinic, we tell everybody what their body mass index is and try to say where they are in their spectrum of that. But how do we define what is a normal BMI?
That's a good question. So we consider a BMI between 20 and 25 to be a normal, healthy weight. Between 25 and 30 is considered overweight. And then when we get to 30, we start using the obesity classification. So between 30 and 35 is class 1 obesity. 35 to 40, class 2 obesity. And a BMI greater than 40 is what we consider class 3 obesity or morbid obesity. And as you mentioned earlier, and as this slide clearly dictates, as the BMI increases, the risk of comorbid medical conditions, and specifically the risk of mortality from those comorbid medical conditions, increases exponentially as the BMI rises.
Very good. The other thing is, we don't. There's been a push to get away from the term morbid obesity, mm-hmm. and they call it extreme obesity. Mm-hmm. But it's important to note that for diagnosis purposes, the ICD-9 code 278.01, which is morbid obesity, mm-hmm. needs to be used for a variety of treatment modalities, specifically bariatric surgery. Mm-hmm. So although we don't use the term with our patients, oh, you're morbidly obese, it is a very important ICD-9 code that will be needed to represent treatment modalities, specifically bariatric surgery. And this diet just looks at the multiple comorbid medical problem of the individual. And there's really not one organ system that's not directly affected negatively to obesity. Oh, I take that back. There is one benefit of being overweight. Do either one of you know what that is?
Decreased risk of osteoporosis.
Yeah, very good. Decreased risk of osteoporosis. That's the only benefit of being overweight. But clearly you can see that every disease, every organ system is directly related to obesity, specifically pulmonary disease. I think the biggest one is obstructive sleep apnea. And screening for obstructive sleep apnea is very, very important, because these patients have a high propensity of obstructive sleep apnea. It's the most underdiagnosed comorbid medical problems, I think, that obese and overweight patients affect today. And they're tired. You know, they wake up with early morning headaches. They don't get into that REM sleep. Mm-hmm. So I think from a pulmonary standpoint, obstructive sleep apnea. The other big issue that's not talked about a lot, but it's a huge issue, is fatty liver disease or steatohepatitis. Directly related to fat in the liver and then inflammation is steatohepatitis. It's the fourth leading cause of liver transplantation, directly related to cirrhosis. The problem is people don't know we have it. And the other scary thing is the liver function studies, the LFTs in the right upper quadrant and ultrasound that are least invasive, are not sensitive nor specific. So about 25% of individuals that have significant steatohepatitis are normal on ultrasound and liver function studies. So I think that is a big problem. The other thing we get a lot of referrals from is from the infertility clinic with polycystic ovarian syndrome, diabetes, metabolic syndrome, degenerative joint disease, and even some cancers. So I think an important take-home point is that even a modest weight loss can have significant impact on every one of these comorbid medical problems. For instance, a 30-pound weight loss of all comers has been shown to decrease apneic episodes in people with obstructive sleep apnea by 50%. It's a huge amount. Mm-hmm. So it's about 5 to 10% weight loss. Also with fatty liver disease, 5 to 10% or about 20 pounds on average has been shown to normalize AST and ALT in the liver function studies. For degenerative joint disease, for every pound we take off, it takes off 5.6 pounds per square inch on our knees. And we all know what happens with improvement of modest weight loss with blood sugar control and metabolic disease. The problem has always been with medical management is that we can't keep it off. So we can lose weight just fine, but always been keeping it off. So in addition to body mass index that we talk about, how we carry our weight is very important. You know, we heard about the apple and the pear. There's two basic types. The apple shape is more visceral fat. That's more around our waist distribution. That's depicted on the right side of the schematic. These individuals have a much higher incidence of diabetes, sleep apnea, fatty liver disease. Compared to the schematic on the left, that individual has more subcutaneous fat around their buttocks and hips, hence the pear shape. That is more cardioprotective. Those individuals usually have a higher HDL cholesterol, a lower incidence of diabetes, sleep apnea, and fatty liver disease. It used to be that women had the pear shape and men had the apple shape. But unfortunately, over the last 25 years with the epidemic of obesity, women have been taking on more of this apple-shaped type of weight distribution. Hence, more diabetes, sleep apnea, cardiovascular disease in women are being diagnosed all the time. And as you recall, it was really a male-predominant disease, diabetes, sleep apnea, fatty liver disease, until postmenopause, when they lose the effect of estrogen, protective effect of estrogen. But because of this weight gain, women have been taking on this apple-shaped type of weight distribution, and they have just as many problems with diabetes and fatty liver disease and the like. So in addition to body mass index, how we carry our weight is very important. Used to be that they wanted us to do a waist-to-hip ratio, but actually a simple waist circumference is just as effective. So in a woman, a waist circumference greater than 35, or in men, a waist circumference greater than 40, connotates that upper body weight distribution, and hence maybe more aggressive treatment options should be warranted in those individuals irrespective of their body mass index. So in addition to body mass index, I think it's important to also check a waist circumference on those patients. So how do we treat obesity? You know, whatever modality we choose, whether we're going to talk in a minute pharmacotherapy and surgery, but really there's no other, there's nothing that will escape the need for diet, exercise, and behavior modification. That has to be the cornerstone. And I think we do a pretty good job at hammering that in our program that, you know, you can have the best medication and the best surgical procedure, but if you don't have the underlying diet and exercise and behavior modification, those individuals are not going to do as well after the medication is stopped or even taking or even after the surgery. So if we look at a treatment modality plan, I'm going to ask Tasha to review what you talk about when your patients come in.
Mm-hmm. Generally, what we do is we have some standard calorie prescriptions, a 1,200 to 1,500 calorie meal plan for most women, 1,500 or maybe even 1,800 to 2,000 calories per day for men. We do focus on fat and have them be controlled with their fat intake. Ideally, no more than 30% of calories should come from fat. But there can also be very simple things. Depending on the patient that you're dealing with, it might just be an issue of portion control. It might be an issue of working on grazing or snacking, eating out. It could be a matter of getting them to do food logs if they're motivated mm-hmm. to do that. Not all patients are motivated to do that or might be even resistant to doing food logs. But food logs can be helpful in keeping track of calories for accountability. We often say in the clinic, before you bite it, write it. So people are often reluctant to write the cheesecake or Oreos if they're eating them late at night. So there is some validity to that. We might use the ADA, the American Diabetes Association, food exchange system for people with diabetes if they need better blood sugar control. But I think with any of these modalities, it really just depends on the patient. We try to tailor each the plan to the individual. So those are some things that we recommend.
Do you change the meal plan, whether they have that apple shape or pear shape we just talked about? Is there a different meal plan that's better for one versus the other?
If we find, you know, if somebody has insulin resistance or if they do have more of that apple shape, we might really hone in more on the carbohydrates and try to encourage that patient to limit their portions of especially starchy foods, which tend to be, as you said earlier, the comfort foods. So we might be a little bit more intense with that restriction. But that would be our general prescription.
Would you go on a low carbohydrate or just compensate in fruits and vegetables, still make it 55% carbohydrates, or do you go lower in those individuals? Just watch the starches.
We usually keep the carbohydrate a little bit lower, but we encourage them to get more of their carbohydrate from fresh fruits and if they're doing breads, whole grain products and whole grain cereals and things like that. So that would be a little bit more
specific. Mediterranean type diet.
Exactly.
Lean meats, fruits, vegetables, legumes, and salads.
Exactly. Right.
You mentioned food logs. I think it's important. Anything we can do to keep our patients accountable. Mm-hmm. And if you look through this list, it's really set up to do that, to keep our patients accountable. And I think Keeping food logs are very, very important. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's been shown to be very helpful in patients that have lost a lot of weight and kept it off is getting weighed on a weekly basis. Mm-hmm. And it's been shown getting weighed on a Monday is the best day, and Friday being the worst day because they get weighed on Friday and then start the weekend and then start back in on Monday. So Clearly, if you can get patients to go get weighed. And the other thing I think is important is that the primary care provider should welcome them back to their mm-hmm. clinic to get weighed, because clearly going outside of their home is better than just getting weighed in their own home.
Right.
So, and it's estimated that they'll decrease about 20 calories, 20% decrease in calories just by going outside their home to getting weighed.
Right.
The other big pet peeve for me is the caloric beverages. You know, where those are the low-hanging fruit. If you only have 3 minutes with the patient and they're struggling with their weight, you know, if you can get them off of the caloric beverages, that is huge, because that is empty calories, and it goes, you know, metabolized very quickly to fat. So that's, and people don't realize that those are calories that they're consuming. And when we take in our beverages, of note that if you can drink something hot, doesn't matter what it is, coffee, tea, bouillon, hot water, but that stimulates our portion in our brain, our satiety center in our hypothalamus, and actually decreases calories. And there was a study done in Boston looking at drinking something hot versus one of the appetite suppressant medications. I don't remember which one it was, but clearly it was almost as effective to drinking something hot with each meal or snack than taking a medication. On the flip side of that, cold carbonated beverages, you know, diet soda, it's diet, which is fine, but the carbonation increases Borg-Borigmi and increases stomach churning and growling, your stomach growling, and that can actually increase your appetite. So drinking something hot is very important to decrease appetite, and drinking cold carbonated beverages in some people can increase.